Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we hear about a new publication devoted to the local foods movement in Tulsa. Edible Tulsa is a locally produced magazine in a network of over 80 edible magazines that are published in communities across the country. It's devoted to changing the way cities shop, cook, eat, and understand locally grown foods. The magazine will tell stories about food artisans and chefs, restaurants, farmers and growers, the foods they're growing and raising, vintners, brewers, and home cooks that are utilizing local foods and ingredients. My guest today is the editor of Edible Tulsa, Valerie Carter. She's a food and wine columnist and a classically trained chef. She's a product of a farm family, and she studied at the Culinary Institute of America in Napa Valley. She's also worked as a chef in hotels, country clubs, and as a personal chef. She's been a culinary arts faculty instructor at OSU Tech for 5 years as well. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Valerie Carter, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And congratulations on this new magazine, Edible Tulsa. How did this come about?
Well, our publisher is named Barry Jarvis, and he has just felt the need to bring Edible to Tulsa, just to focus on local food and sustainable food, farms, food artisans, that kind of thing.
Our local food movement has been growing. What has started that, and what's been the reason for its growth so much?
I think people are more interested in what they're eating and what they're putting into their bodies now more than ever. And, you know, maybe that has to do with just the sheer wealth that we have, and we can be so choosy at this point. But I think on the flip side of that, people are seeing what putting non-nutritious food in their bodies is doing to them. And so they're concerned, and they're believing now that there is some direct correlation between what you eat and your health.
Do you think it's a matter of this sort of movement taking its time to filter to places like the Midwest, where you have the strong meat and potatoes element? And I think there's probably a belief that, you know, meat and potatoes, you know, they come from nearby or something like that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, right.
This sort of Midwestern stock of food that we tend to eat in this part of the country.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I think that we're behind, just like we are with art and fashion and pop culture even. And it does filter to us maybe 10 years down the road. But yeah, people here maybe are a little more used to meat and potatoes. I mean, we are more farm and agriculture oriented, and so that has kind of lingered with us more than it has, say, on the coast. And then also, I think just because of where we live, you know, seasonally, it's hard to grow a lot here. It's not like we live in California and San Joaquin Valley. I mean, we're not growing 12 months out of the year. So it's more difficult for us, but I think it's important for us to find ways to do that, whether it be using our own flower beds. Instead of just putting beautiful flowers in there, we could be putting blueberry bushes in there, or using it for root vegetables, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Once upon a time, this part of the country did have a thriving sort of vegetable market as a part of the agricultural scene. I mean, Bixby is, and the farms around there are sort of the last remnants of that from the old days, because they stayed around for the most part. But, you know, as the ability to flash freeze took over, a lot of that went away. It's pretty difficult to reestablish that. It seems like it's been that way, at least in Oklahoma.
I think it is hard to reestablish that. I think that much of the good farmland that people were using for produce at one time. Yeah, well, houses, and even before they were used for houses, they started, were used for commodity crops. And of course, that strips out nutrients over time. And then, yeah, they were used for commerce and housing.
It's taken a while to get that going. And it seems like we're just now getting to the point where there are these new generation of farmers who are growing like a half acre, an acre, acre and a half, towards the farmer's market.
I think that the farmer's markets are obviously going to be the biggest outlet, but I think that the knowledge is just not there for people my age and generations younger than me. People don't know how to farm. I mean, just even basic things like how to take care of your flower beds, that's something that people rely on their moms and their grandmas to help them with. And the same thing with gardening. And so to say, oh, I'm going to buy a couple of acres and I'm going to grow produce on that, I think it's a very difficult task, especially because people are trying to do that organically now. I think that's a big thing. And that's a hard thing to do because there's not as much information out there. I mean, if you were going to call OSU Extension, they would be able to help you, but you have to be very specific about that you want to do it organically. And so mm-hmm. I just think that there are just some stumbling blocks that we need to overcome here.
I was just thinking, my mother knew how to can. That's probably a lost art for a lot of people.
It's
now.
A lost art, but it's kind of like knitting. It's coming back with the generations of 20s, 30s, 40s-year-olds because we missed out on that and we want to learn how to do that. And so we're relying on our moms and grandmothers to remind us how to do some of those things.
So what is the focus of Edible Tulsa? What are you going to focus on as editor as far as the local foods movement here in Tulsa?
There's so much to report on that it's kind of hard to boil it down. I mean, we want to talk about local food. We want to show the local artisans who are making bread, making wine, making beer, making anything from scratch, as well as those who are sourcing their ingredients locally using local farms. And, you know, it's not entirely possible to do all the time. And so what we would encourage people to do is to source locally when you can. But then other than that, I mean, we obviously realize that you cannot get salmon in Oklahoma yet.
You mentioned the farmers markets as being important. I think when you go to the farmers market, if you left for a year, it's unbelievable the amount of growth in the main farmers market. And we're starting to get that volume issue, which I think is helpful to the consumer. But there's also a process of educating consumers about locally grown food. You can't buy locally grown food as cheap as you could a flash frozen food that was grown in California or Peru, for that matter.
That's true. And there's a couple of points on that. One, we like to encourage people when they do go to the farmers market to buy 2, 3, 4 times as much as they actually need and learn how to put those things up. Canning, freezing, pureeing, and again, canning. But they're all different ways to put those up. And so it can be cheaper. And then for people who maybe the farmers market prices do seem out of reach, all of the farmers markets that I know of do offer some sort of program like Double Up Food Bucks where they take SNAP dollars and those are matched. And so there's all kinds of good matching programs for people who might not otherwise be able to attend the market.
Yeah. In your first issues, you're kind of coming in, starting this as the growing season's coming to an end. The harvest is coming in at the end.
That's true.
What are the things you're focusing on in the magazine right now?
Well, it's interesting because in our holiday issue, we do have an hors d'oeuvre party where we have sourced as much as we can locally. So that was a very challenging thing to do in November and December. But our creative director, Judy Allen, pulled that off. And so it's not that every single ingredient in that hors d'oeuvre party is sourced from right here around Tulsa, but many components make that dish. As a matter of fact, salmon is one of those things. She makes a gravlax that's beet cured. So the beets are local. They make a beautiful color on the salmon. And it's a perfect opportunity to use some local product and then kind of, you know, a finer, fancy, if you will, gourmet product.
Well, give us a sense of what would be in an hors d'oeuvre party that you can do locally.
This time of year,
yeah.
There's all kinds of root, especially right
root,
now.
Root vegetables.
That's a great thing to do. Cauliflower, you can do, of course, some of the heartier winter greens like kale and the cabbages. Those are great right now. So there are definitely some things that you can do.
Mm-hmm. Now, the other thing the publication is doing is focusing on two things involved with the restaurant industry. One is restaurants that are sourcing locally for a lot of their foods, and also the process by which the farmers market and the local foods get beyond just the farmers markets to this sort of industrial supply chain that affects restaurants and, you know, larger concerns beyond the grocery store, you know, into purveyors system. What have you found out so far about that?
Well, one of the most interesting restaurants that's really doing a great job and trying very hard to source locally is Tallgrass Prairie Table. Mm-hmm. They source as much as they can from the Living Kitchen in Depew. And the Living Kitchen grows many different kinds of produce. They have goats, so they have cheeses and milk. And Tallgrass Prairie Table uses as many ingredients as they can, as well as from other local farms. But they are doing an excellent job. Lucky's does an excellent job. The Canebrake does an excellent job. That's their resort and spa in Wagner. Mm-hmm. They actually have a little garden where they grow some of their own herbs and a few vegetables. And I don't know the legality on foraging, but I know that some restaurants can do a little bit of foraging too.
Now, is that something that's going to have to change the legislation? Because, you know, I know in a lot of cases, some of our laws concerning health and produce and the like are not really set up for a local supply chain.
Even fishing. I mean, that's one of the interesting things too, is that I don't know all of the rules on the fish, but I know that you can't just send your sous chef out to go fishing and catch some catfish and come back and fry it up. You can't do that here. So anyway, I think some of those rules maybe need to be looked at and some of the foraging rules, just because those opportunities are there for us, but if there are limitations because of the law, that's unfortunate.
Now, when you say the word foraging, the only thing I can think of is like pigs and truffles or wild mushrooms, mm-hmm. but are you talking a lot more than that?
Yeah, I mean, there are all kinds of things that we don't see in the grocery stores or even the farmers markets just because they haven't become popular, and so they're not something that you can get readily. Ramps, mushrooms, all different kinds of herbs. Watercress would be something that you would find, you know, along a stream maybe. Mm-hmm. And it's not something that you're going to find fresh in your supermarket and maybe even at the farmer's market, but it's something that chefs might be able to go out and get. And I know that they can do that in some places.
My guest today is Valerie Carter. She is the editor of Edible Tulsa. It's a new magazine that's focusing on local foods. You mentioned some of the restaurants that are using local ingredients and locally sourced. Is it difficult for a restaurant to find these local ingredients in the quantities that they need to have a ready source so you can actually put it on the menu and it actually be on the menu day in and day out?
Right. That's actually one of the big hurdles, is because you might not be able to get all the bok choy that you need from one grower. So you might have to go from table to table to table at the market to get as much as you need. I know that the Cherry Street Farmers Market is working on a program now that possibly we could take all of the produce, say bok choy, take all the bok choy from at the end of the market on Saturday and have it available for the chefs to get, say, on either Saturday evening or Sunday, so they'd have it for that next week.
Well, this brings up another issue, which has been a bigger issue in California, which is that, you know, the popularity of local foods has become so essential to running a restaurant in, say, Southern California or Northern California. You know, the farmers markets are sold out by 8 or 9 o'clock. They're really functioning more like a wholesale market for restaurateurs. Are we seeing that issue in Oklahoma yet?
I don't think that we have that problem yet. I think that that is maybe a good problem to have in some ways, but I don't think we're there yet, because I know that, unfortunately, at the end of a farmer's market, we're still having growers that go away with a lot of produce at the end of the day. And that's not where we want to be. We want to have them selling out. And, you know, we want them to be able to keep up with the demand and not overwork themselves at the same time. I just think that we need to increase awareness and get more people out there. And maybe there needs to be extended hours to the farmer's market, maybe more days to the farmer's market.
When you go to other cities, there's a designated space for the farmer's market. So I'm thinking of like City Market in Kansas City, mm-hmm. or Eastern Market in Washington, D.C., or
Public Market in Seattle.
Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. All of these markets are really set for these growers to come in. You know, you maybe come in twice a week. You have your little space, but you know it's always going to be there, and it's there all day, you know, on the market day that they're operating.
Right.
And that seems to be a big boon for people planning their shopping, because most of our farmers markets are for a matter of hours.
Right, in a parking lot somewhere.
In a parking lot, yeah, or in the street, and you can't keep the street closed.
Right.
How important is that to the local food movement, do you think, in really extending the reach of the local food movement?
I think we've probably reached that point where the market needs its own place, that people know that they can always go there. I mean, I would personally love to see some sort of market developed that there were shops open every day, that the farmers could come in and sell their wares on maybe a couple of days a week, but then anything they had left over would be left in some sort of general store. And that could also be a great opportunity for the chefs to be able to come and get their produce and other things too, like Loma Dairy or Lavera's or somewhere that has dairy products. If you can only get those for 4 hours a week at the farmer's market, it sure cuts down on what a consumer can get. So if we were to have some shops open at a single place that were open all week, that would be great.
Have you begun to investigate that?
Well, I know that the Cherry Street Farmers Market is maybe exploring some opportunities of what mm-hmm. they might do, because it is limiting for the number of hours a day that it is. And I think that everybody is aware that some expansion and growth is possible if we had a permanent location.
Yeah. That's about all you can say at this point.
Yeah.
My guest today is Valerie Carter. She's the editor of Edible Tulsa, a new food and wine publication dedicated to the local food movement here in Tulsa and the surrounding area. This is your second issue, I guess, now.
It is.
What are sort of the things have you been covering so far?
Wineries, coffee shops, restaurants. We've covered a couple of restaurants that, you know, we're locally sourcing. Mm-hmm. Each publication is going to have a triple take. And so that's going to be a focus on one ingredient or technique, and it's going to be a take from a chef, the Edible Tulsa Kitchen, as well as a great home cook. And so on our first issue, we used apples. The Edible Tulsa Kitchen did an apple tart, our home cook did an apple pie, and our professional, which was the Crane Break, they did a caramelized apple tart, I believe. And so this time we used winter squash, same thing. And so each edition we'll be focusing in on a seasonal ingredient and try to get some different viewpoints of how to prepare that the best.
Now, do you look for completely different ways of preparing that ingredient? Like the home chef's going to take the economical way as far as time and effort. Maybe the restaurant chef is going to be a little more fussy or you know, a little more creative in the preparation. How do you approach these?
Yeah, you're exactly right. So the home cook, we think, might do something a little more basic or a little more expected. The professional side of it is probably going to bring something a little more exotic to the proverbial table and hopefully use some techniques that are, you know, different than what your home cook is going to be using. And of course, their plating and their presentation are going to be, you know, elevated a little bit. And then I think from an Edible Tulsa Kitchen approach, we try to do something that also teaches a lot of technique.
So what are some of the techniques you've taught so far?
Well, moving away from the triple take, we actually also have a 101 series, and I think that's kind of morphing into something called ingredients and technique, but still it's going to be technique centered. And so in our first issue, we did a braised lamb shank. And so there was a lot to learn from that as far as a braising technique and why that happens and trying to extract gelatin from bone so that you have a really luscious sauce, that kind of thing. Uh-huh. And then our 101 in the holiday issue was a beef rib roast, a bone-in beef rib roast. Mm-hmm. And so we just talked about, you know, what are the specifics that go into creating a beautiful, perfectly cooked, perfectly medium rare or rare cooked bone-in rib roast.
Now, do you get into the issues of how to source those meats locally as well?
Yeah, with almost every one of the recipes that we do, we try to make sure that it's something that can be sourced locally, and we give some sourcing information on those.
Mm-hmm. You know, I would think a lot of our locally sourced meats, there are certain aspects to them that make them a little different, like they'll be grass-fed or they'll be, you know, no antibiotics in that. Does that make a difference in the final product?
It does.
Can it be, I mean, like maybe a little more lean than people expect or?
Yeah, I think because we have been, you know, feeding our animals corn for so long.
Lots of fat.
Yeah, we expect it to be a certain way. And so animals that are grass-fed and free-range, that kind of thing, they're going to be a little bit leaner. And they also have a slightly gamier taste. And I think for some people who've been raised on, you know,
the feedlot,
Safeway feedlot meat, that they don't expect that, and so even beef to them can taste a little bit gamey. But it's just the process, the learning process.
Is there different ways of cooking when you have a far leaner, say a leaner rib roast than you're used to getting from the store, which would be a lot more fatty?
Well, I think you just have to watch the cooking time on that. I mean, I don't think it's going to be greatly different.
Not a lot of difference.
No.
As you've been getting into this, now your background, you were a writer, you've been a food and wine columnist, you worked in kitchens, you're CIA trained, and how did you come up on doing this particular magazine at this particular point in your life?
Well, I think it was just a strike of great luck and maybe some prayers along with that. It's a great fit for me. I mean, I have an English background, I have a culinary background, and I had just kind of wanted to get into a little bit of writing, and I started out writing for Green Country Living magazine. That was kind of like my tiny little foot in the door. And then that turned into Tulsa World with a Busy Kitchen and writing every other week for them, which was totally great. And so I think it just kind of helped get my name out there a little bit. And it's great. It allows me to be creative in the kitchen and do some writing and then also help, you know, talk about some of these things that are important to me.
Now, you mentioned the Edible Tulsa Kitchens, which that makes it kind of sounds like America's Test Kitchen or something like that. But I assume you're actually doing some recipe testing?
We do. And yeah, I mean, recipe testing goes into everything that we do. We wouldn't print anything that we wouldn't, you know, have tested. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
What now, how much trial and error is actually, I mean, because you're an experienced chef, you know pretty much how this is going to turn out. But do you actually do quite a bit of testing, or is it just a matter of, okay,
tweaking.
Let's get the,
more tweaking. Yeah. I mean, because it's not like we're starting from ground zero. Frankly, nobody's starting from ground zero anymore from Escoffier on up. I mean, you know, at this point, nobody's really creating anything new. It's not that anyone's copying from anybody else. It's just that there are not that any new flavor combinations. So, but as far as recipe testing, we're definitely doing that, and it's one of the most fun parts of the job.
I would imagine, yeah. Right. That's the part I would want to watch. Well, what are some of the things that are coming up for the magazine? Can you talk a little bit about what you're expecting? I mean, seems like winter would be the tough time for a local foods magazine, or are there things that are still going on in the winter?
Yeah, there's still lots of great things that are going on. It doesn't have to be just about produce. It's a great time for us to talk about dairies. It's a great time for us to talk about locally sourcing meat, Night Creek pecans, honey. I mean, there's things that are going on all the time that don't necessarily have to do with, you know, sprouts coming out of the ground. And also, I mean, that's one of the columns that we're going to have in January, February issue, is what to do in your garden to get it ready for spring. So if you've never had a garden before, but you want to, you need to get our issue to figure it out.
Yeah. And I assume that's going to be an area of emphasis, is making sure that people, even in their backyards or if they have a patio.
Container gardening,
they can get that going. The other thing having to do with Food 101 is, you know, a lot of times cooking is a lost art. People want to.
It's true.
Are you going to get into that realm as well of just sort of discussing basic cooking techniques?
And actually, I think
there's a lot of different ways to get that information.
Well, I mean, I think that you're exactly right, though. That's one of the big hurdles in getting people to eat better, is just getting people back to the basics of cooking. I mean, we were talking about canning and gardening and knitting and that kind of thing. Cooking falls into that exact same category. People have, you know, they have more education and they work more, and we have kids and we all, you know, go to soccer games 5 nights a week and that kind of thing. But really, if we can get people back into the kitchen, it's not spending 2 hours for dinner every night, but just, you know, basically knowing how to saute, how to roast, how to grill, just some really basic techniques. If you have some good, fresh food, it's not a long process.
Yeah. And I assume another area of that the magazine is going to explore is hopefully to build more interest in building up the infrastructure of local foods. I mean, you have the farmers markets. As the demand ramps up, do you have any fears about the supply being able to keep up, that there will be enough? You know, I look at a lot of the people that are growing foods. I mean, there's this new generation of sort of back to the earth farmers that are a part of that. Can if demand does go up, do you think the supply will still be there?
Well, I'm hoping that the interest will be generated on both sides of it, not just the consumers, but that the more success that small farmers have, that other people will also have interest in that and think that they can make a living doing that same thing.
Do you think the farmers that have been, say, more towards commodities like, you know, corn, wheat, who have always maybe had vegetable gardens on the side, or maybe thinking about doing more of the local foods? Because, you know, the price on local foods are certainly a little better. There's still a lot of hard work, and there's a lot of hard work in delivering and bringing the product to market.
Well, I think that the large commodity farmers have a couple of great opportunities. One, they usually have some land available that they could do some small plots and do some trial plots. And also, they have that basic farm knowledge that they could be passing on to other small farmers who might just be getting in the game. I mean, not many people have a farming background anymore. And so if they could, even if commodity farmers are not practicing the principles that you might want to use in your sustainable organic farm, they still know a lot of basics that we can learn from those people. And I hope that those farmers would be willing to share their information, and that the younger generation of farmers would be willing to learn from them.
All right. The name of the publication is Edible Tulsa. Do you have a website?
We do. EdibleTulsa.com.
All right. Well, Valerie, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Valerie Carter is the editor of Edible Tulsa magazine. Their second issue, their holiday issue, is now available at retailers around the area, as well as libraries and bookstores. Information at EdibleTulsa.com. Now another conversation from StoryCorps in Tulsa. In this conversation, Pamela Rosa Scott Vickers interviews her uncle, Frederick Davis Sr. Uncle Fred, as Pamela and many others like to call him, was active in Tulsa for many years as a small business owner and a community activist. He was president of the local chapter of the NAACP for several years and also chaired the War on Poverty in Tulsa. But in this part of their conversation, he tells Pamela about running a popular watering hole in the 1960s, well before liquor by the drink, called the Showboat.
Your life in this community, even though you've traveled everywhere, nationally, internationally, as we think about this community, you had ownership in this community through several endeavors. And I remember my dad was bartender at one of them.
Yeah, I had think it was in the 60s. I owned a club called Showboat. And this was a time when Oklahoma was dry. You couldn't sell whiskey by the drink. But the country clubs could sell it. So if the country clubs could sell it, I said to the chief of police, explain something to me. You guys can go to the Tulsa Club and y'all can have drinks. We can serve you at the Tulsa Club and ain't nobody going to jail. But when we come off of that job and come back to our community, what do we do? And he said, I never thought about it like that, Fred. I said, well, think about it. We don't have country clubs. We got waiters that wait for y'all at the country club. But when they come home, they got to buy them a half a pint. And they got to sit down someplace like the Pig Ale and have their little girlfriend or wife to come out there and have Jesse or somebody to cook them a chicken or cook them a steak. And then you're going to come in there and you're going to arrest them for selling whiskey across the bar. But they ain't got no choice. I said, so if you work all day to serve whiskey, and then when you get off from work, your feet hurt and you want to go somewhere where you can sit down and relax with your wife or your girlfriend, have you a drink, have you something to eat, and you're going to get put in jail for doing that? I said, y'all need to understand that all they're trying to do is have their own country club. They trying to have a country club like you got one. So when I told him that, he said, well, what do you suggest, Fred? I said, well, I'm going to have a country club and charge $2 membership. So it's a private club. So I charge $2 membership. So if I charge $2 membership, everybody a member. So when you come in there, everybody got a membership card. So if everybody got a membership card, I ain't selling no bad whiskey. I'm selling to my members.
And I had no idea that that's how you did it. It reminds me of what I've heard. You know, you when you learn the rules, then they change the rules. Now, I don't know if the rules change, but you were able to play that game, for want of a different term. But I do remember it was a very nice club at the corner of Cincinnati and Pine Street.
Yeah.
And I guess I was of age at that time because I had a chance to go in there. And it was such a nice place. And I, like I said, I remember my daddy was one of your bartenders. And I think he enjoyed that.
Well, we served the upper class. Because they was all members.
Okay.
I mean, they had to pay $2. And it was it's so funny because at that time, TU had a lot of black basketball players.
Uh-huh.
Herb Collins was one of them. He since died, but Herb Collins was one. They called me Uncle Fred. So what they would do is they'd bring their little girlfriend to Showboat so they could have them a party. I had to sponsor the party because they didn't have no money. But they didn't have to worry about going to jail because it was a private club. And all of them had membership.
All right.
But it was, it's how do you take a given situation and figure out how to do something about it? And that's what I did.
Pamela Vickers interviewing her uncle, Frederick Davis Sr., at the StoryCorps booth at the Guthrie Green in downtown Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.